May it please the court.
I'd like to give the court a little background at the risk of repeating what the briefing's done. This case started when Mr. Rotel and his company built a very expensive home for Joan Cutting. And Ms. Cutting was not happy with it, and Mr. Rotel thought he was happy with his performance. She sued. And Mr. Rotella was pro se in front of Judge Collier, and it resulted in a very large judgment against him. Midcont, however, did not provide a defense pursuant to the insurance policy, and they were obligated to provide a defense under the general liability portions of it and the builder's risk portion of it. They did neither. I was not representing Mr. Rotella at the time that the Cutting litigation occurred. I did, however, represent Mr. Rotella in suing Midcontinent. We filed a lawsuit in State District Court in Dallas. That lawsuit was removed to federal court before Judge Fish. We then went to mediation, and that's where the issue was created. Judge Fish appointed a mediator, and we went to mediation. Mr. Mitchell, on behalf of Midcontinent, and I and our respective client reps entered into a settlement agreement whereby $200,000 should be paid, not on the main case, not on the bad faith insurance practices, just on underlying attorney's fees. For whatever reason, $200,000 was to be paid. It was not. Instead, what happened was Joan Cutting filed a writ of garnishment. And Midcontinent then interpled the funds before Judge Collier. That triggers the competing claims. Judge Collier entered an order that says that first in time, first in right, and ignores the contingent fee agreement that I had with Mark Rotella.
So today, your position is it's a contingent fee agreement. It's not an assignment, it's not an equitable interest, it's a contingency fee agreement.
It's all of the above, Your Honor. It's all of the above. When I drafted that contract, and Mr. Rotella agreed to it, two contracting parties, he pledged any interest out of this litigation.
Can you refresh my memory where I found it and read it?
Your Honor, it's in Volume 1.
It's in the clerk's record. It's not an attachment.
Oh, no, Your Honor. It's in Volume 1 of the clerk's record.
I thought it specifically said this was an assignment and not a contingency fee contract.
Oh, Your Honor.
But I don't have it in front of me. So.
Wait, quite frankly, it's both.
Despite its work, despite what it may say, it is all of the above. Okay. I had it. This is on my desk. Okay.
Yeah, and when that was drafted, Judge, the contracting parties, meaning Mark Rotella and me and my law firm, had that specific conversation. There are all kinds of he's been through a lot. He and his company have been through a lot, like a lot of home builders. And I was worried about trying to get paid. And he had no problem with it, but he wanted to give me specific interest in that money. And what Judge Collier did, however, is say $200,000 goes to Joan Cutting and deprived me and my law firm from getting that money, specifically me. Then another point I'd like the court to consider is the related causes of action. Why Judge Collier dismissed the bad faith insurance practices? There's no evidence that automatically entitles him to go ahead and dismiss that cause of action. When Judge Fish appointed Jeff Abrams.
Oh, wait a minute. There's no evidence to allow him to dismiss it. Now, what were we talking about? Motion for summary judgment, traditional, no evidence?
Yes.
All right. So What do you mean there's no evidence to allow him to do that?
There's no evidence for him to dismiss the bad faith insurance practices claim when Judge Fish sent us to Jeff Abrams, the mediator. And that settlement agreement was to be held in confidence. And that confidentiality was breached. There's no evidence to show, as a matter of law, that Judge Cleaver can dismiss that claim.
Okay. I'm not connecting the dots, but okay.
And that's also related to whether we're entitled to go ahead and take a deposition of Joan Cutting. That's very problematic, in my opinion, with all due respect to this honorable court. That's why we're entitled to do discovery, and His Honor did not allow us to do that.
And my recollection is that the briefing on that point from Mid-Continent says Rotella and Cole similarly alleged that they were deprived of the chance to develop factual evidence but do not specify what evidence they would have been able to produce, nor do they argue that the trial court's decision was an abuse of discretion. Of course, my question to them is, how do you find out what you're going to find out until you take the deposition? But my question to you is, seems like you had to put on some evidence of where you were going, what you were trying to find out to show that there was some relevance or materiality.
You know, I was worried about you putting the pipe between my eyes on that issue. And, Your Honor, you're exactly right. But I will not file a pleading unless I know what I can go ahead and put on. And until I take her deposition, I don't know what she's going to say or what she's not going to say.
Okay. I'm going to ask my law clerk to go get the clerk's record, which is on my desk, and find the contract in question. Thank you.
That's in Volume 1.
Thank you. Okay, let's go ahead.
Last issue, Judge, and I'll just be short on the last issue. Attorney's fees against me and Mark Rotella. That wasn't before the court. Judges awarded $17,000 in change. Attorney's fees against me. And that wasn't part of the pleading. That wasn't part of the motion for summary judgment.
All right, so it's unpled is the bottom line.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And no proof of it.
I didn't pick that up. All right.
And it's 17 and change before the trial court, and I think an additional $5,000 before this honorable court.
Now hopefully that's conditional. I'm sure it's conditional.
You mean on the additional $5,000? Yes, Your Honor. That's it, memory serves. Yes, Your Honor. Now, let me return to, and it's not a throwaway argument, but it's a very technical argument. Under the insurance code, those proceeds cannot be garnished. Now, this honorable court absolutely is going to recognize that Joan Cutting has a final judgment. But part of issue number one that we briefed.
Are you talking about 1108.051 of the insurance code?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, how do you respond? And again, I'll read the brief here. In fact, courts have specifically held that the proceeds or benefits of commercial liability policies are not the kind of insurance protected under the terms of this section of the insurance code. How do you respond to that? Distinguishing the types of insurance policies and companies.
Your Honor, I can't reconcile it other than defer to the statute. That's what the statute says. But here's a dovetail argument. And I'm not trying to argue. I am, in part, Your Honor, trying to argue for my money. You know, but how can Judge Collier go ahead and adjudicate the entire $200,000 in favor of Joan Cutting? That $200,000 has two components to it. Three components to it. Mark Rotella, Mark Rotella Custom Homes, and then Robert R. Cole Jr. and his law firm. And what Judge Collier did is take the entire $200,000 away from, as I referred to in my brief, the Cole Group.
I thought the whole $200,000. Your position was it was yours for your attorney's fees. Doesn't have anything to do with child support or
ends
or anything. It's your attorney's fees.
Oh, Your Honor, if that's the way my brief reads, then let me correct it right now.
Okay.
I disagree. I had a 45% contingent fee interest in that $200,000.
Okay.
So if I misbriefed it, my sincerest apology.
My bad.
Let me just, issue number two, I've already addressed that. Oh, Your Honor, that's a great question, and I'm sorry. We lawyers get so hung up in all the detail and workup. Yeah, here's what happened in before Jeff Abrams, the mediator, the court-appointed mediator by Judge Fish. Mid-Continent did not want to settle the underlying litigation. In other words, the Rotella Group versus Mid-Continent on the insurance policy. Instead, Mid-Continent said, let's just go ahead and come to a number on the attorney's fees that were incurred before Cole. And that's what we settled on. So the $200,000 had nothing to do with the underlying cause of action against Mid-Continent for not providing a defense or indemnifying. Your Honor, she interpled, she intervened in Judge Fish's court. So she was there present at the mediation. But we had a mediation settlement agreement that, by the terms of the agreement, was supposed to be held in confidence. Joan Cutting was not supposed to know the terms of that. The $200,000, Your Honor, was for the underlying attorney's fees.
Right. It's all supposed to be for attorney's fees. It has nothing to do with defense costs. It's not their obligation to pay a judgment. Right? Okay.
Yes. Yeah, Judge, I don't know if your court papers reflect that, but that's a correct statement.
All right. I still can't find the contract. I found the acknowledgement. Okay, that's all right. I've read it.
Well, I'll find it for you, Judge. I'll give you a specific reference.
I bet these lawyers over here have it. I'll show it to them.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Moran, I believe you're next.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Michael Moran, and I represent Joan Cutting. I have been down here and argued before the three of you against Mr. Cole for the underlying judgment that made the basis of this garnishment action. And one of the important things that I would like for this panel to keep in mind is that the key issues related to the interpleader, whether or not the garnishment should have been dissolved, the protective orders and the attorney's fees are all on an abuse of discretion standard. And the trial court found and was given more than sufficient evidence in the underlying court to see that the decisions that it made were proper and appropriate, and he certainly did not abuse his discretion in the decisions that he made. Now,
tell me about denying discovery. That's something I certainly was loath to do on the trial bench.
Well, the representation that it was a denial of discovery, I don't believe is accurate. This protective order was for a subpoena for a hearing on whether or not the garnishment should have been dissolved.
Okay.
There was no protective order. There was nothing that prohibited Mark Rotella or the Cole parties from taking Ms. Cutting's deposition. There's nothing that prohibited from requesting documents, sending written discovery or anything along those lines. The protective order was issued because there was a hearing on a motion to dissolve the garnishment. And 2 days before the hearing, a subpoena was issued to Ms. Cutting. She was out of state, and she was on a vacation with her grandson. And so we weren't able to get in front of the court fast enough, so she flew down and had to cancel the vacation. And then the hearing got canceled at the 11th hour, so then a new subpoena was issued for the same hearing. We filed a motion for protective order. Then another subpoena was issued to have Ms. Cutting attend the protective order hearing, and the basis of the protective order was the cost and expense and the time that Ms. Cutting would have to come and spend being at the courthouse when there was no nothing proffered that would indicate that there was any testimony that she could provide that would be helpful at all, because the facts that were in her affidavit that she had a valid judgment and that there weren't sufficient assets to take care of the judgment, all of those facts had been admitted already in the motion to dissolve that had been filed by opposing counsel. And so that was the reason why the protective order was entered. With regard to, yes.
My memory thought that someone wanted to take her deposition. That's wrong.
That is correct, Your Honor.
All right.
The court also asked a very pointed question about whether or not this was an assignment. I think this is an important issue for us to discuss somewhat.
Do you happen to have a copy of which I can't seem to locate?
I do not seem to have a copy of it. I think I had a quote in my, may have had a quote in my brief of the language where it says, this is an assignment of an interest in the insurance proceeds, and this is not a contingency fee agreement. It is not like a car wreck where you would get a percentage of the damages. This is an assignment where it lasts. Even if the coal parties no longer represent Mr. Rotella, they still have an assigned interest. That's what the provision says, and I know exactly what provision you're talking about.
What difference?
Well, it makes a difference in if, well, first they need to show by a preponderance of the evidence why they actually have a superior right to these funds prior to Ms. Cutting entering her garnishment. And if it's an assignment, which he's claimed it's an assignment, his brief says it's an assignment, although the settlement agreement that he signed says that there is no assignment, that's part of the issue. It's clearly unclear. They are not able to show by a preponderance of the evidence what interest Mr. Cole has. There were, when we were in federal district court.
Well, aren't they showing that it's a 45% interest? Now, what you call it?
He's calling a 45% transfer. I mean, there's a difference between, I see a difference between an ownership of the claim and an interest that is given in a contingency fee agreement. In the contingency fee agreement, the attorney can't just prosecute the suit on his own. He's given an interest in it, but ultimately there has to be some type of resolution, some type of judgment, some type of award that he gets a percentage of. With an assignment, Mr. Cole's position is that he owns it. He can do whatever he wants with it. And it is an actual transfer of a right. It's the actual transfer of the right, and that's what the policy says specifically you cannot do unless you have written approval from Mid-Continent Casualty Company, which he doesn't have, which is nowhere in the record, and it never occurred. This assignment is void on its face. Because what he's here arguing is that he is entitled to an interest, that he has ownership in this portion of the funds, but he doesn't have an ownership in the portion of the funds because it comes from the insurance policy, which says that the interest in anything that comes out of that policy cannot be transferred unless the insurance company permits it,
right.
And it never occurred.
The
settlement was for payment of insurance proceeds, and the insurance proceeds happened to cover some underlying defense costs from the underlying case.
Yeah, it's a liability policy, right?
It is a commercial general liability policy.
Duty to defend and duty to pay a judgment. And it's my understanding, but I haven't seen the documents either, that the settlement in Judge Fish's court was only for the defense costs, which would be attorney's fees.
It's my understanding that they settled the duty to defend portion of the federal lawsuit. That's correct.
How does he get his money?
Well, it's our position that he doesn't. And in the Bashara case,
what was the $200 for?
The $200 was for, well, first of all, it's not work that Mr. Cole did. So we need to back up a little bit. This is not work that Mr. Cole did. This is work that the prior lawyer,
the underlying
lawyer did.
Mr. Cole.
Yes.
So your position is the $200 was for defending the underlying lawsuit and for that lawyer, not Mr. Cole.
Correct.
But
and
given to Rotella. Rotella as the insured.
Correct.
It's his obligation to pay his lawyers?
It's Mr. Rotella's obligation to pay his lawyers. And if we're talking about claiming an equitable interest in this, there is no equitable interest. If we're talking about an assignment, the assignment's void on its face because, again, it's an interest in the insurance policy. And what Mr. Cole is saying is that I'm entitled to 45% of anything that comes out of that policy, whether you color it as indemnity, whether you color it as bad faith claim, whether you color it as defense costs, because these weren't defense costs for Mr. Cole. These were defense costs from the underlying claim. But nonetheless, the policy says that if you want to assign anything that comes out of this policy, you've got to get our permission. And the settlement proceeds from the settlement agreement don't just come out of thin air. They come out of the policy. And when you look at the Gertie's...
The settlement wouldn't be there if they hadn't hired the lawyer, right?
Yeah, I mean, yes, arguably, yes, that's true.
So the lawyer did the work to get the money that was owed.
The subsequent lawyer did the work to get the money for what was owed.
And the subsequent lawyer shouldn't be paid.
Well, when Ms. Cutting has a superior right to those funds as a judgment creditor. If you look at the Bashara Texas Supreme Court case, it talks about the common fund doctrine. Common fund doctrine, which was a new argument, but it does point out the issue that we're facing here. The common fund doctrine says if you have a common fund or a common interest, then you should have some type of equitable division of the funds. Well, what the Texas Supreme Court said in Bashara was that while Ms. Cutting, or in this situation it was a hospital, benefited from obtaining the funds that the attorney obtained, it was still, because it was a creditor, it had a superior right to those funds over the lawyer. And you all have seen this all the time. What happens when you have a car wreck case and somebody has a hospital lien for their injuries? The plaintiff's lawyer doesn't take the case without going to the hospital, getting the liens worked out so that he knows, okay, well, maybe work the liens down, I'll pay you a percentage of the liens to the hospital, and then he gets a percentage over that. And so there is some type of deal worked out. But what happened here was that Rotella files suit in state court, gets removed to federal court. Ms. Cutting is added to the case. She didn't intervene in the case. She's added to the case by Mid-Continent because they believed she had an interest in the insurance policy because of the judgment. And then they try to keep the settlement confidential. They try to keep Ms. Cutting away from it. So this is not a situation where they tried to work it out on the front end, because the Bashara case and cases like this are out there, because it does recognize the fact that a judgment creditor has the right over the lawyer, even though the lawyer has done the work, and it's the lawyer. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
That's what you want to do. That's fine.
No.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
What happened to the Ms. Cutting has an interesting that the having her judgment paid, but what happened to that portion of the coverage suit in Judge Fish's court?
The portion of the coverage suit, that was settled. She settled that directly with Mid-Continent, and there was an agreement to a reduction of the judgment by whatever portion of the judgment could have been covered by the insurance policy, which include attorney's fees, interest, and the construction defects. So the remaining portion of the judgment just relates to the theft of $750,000 and the treble damages and the attorney's fees and interest that relate to that.
Give Mr. Cole an additional 3 minutes. And give Mr. Mitchell a couple of extra minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Aaron Mitchell. I represent Mid-Continent Casualty. Mr. Cole's brief is not adequate to preserve. There are basically two issues here as to Mid-Continent. Number one, the propriety of the summary judgment with regard to Rotella's causes of action against Mid-Continent arising out of the interpleader, and then there's the attorney fee issue. With regard to the summary judgment, Mr. Cole's brief is inadequate to preserve any error. It consists of about three or four pages of briefing, and essentially what it says is that I, as counsel for Mid-Continent, had in my hand a check representing the settlement proceeds, which I did not tender to Mr. Cole prior to the time Mid-Continent was obligated under its settlement to pay that money, and that I accepted service of a writ of garnishment on behalf of my client rather than forcing Mr. Moran to go through formal channels to serve that writ on Mid-Continent. After setting out those facts, what the brief simply does is says, therefore, there are fact issues as to my claim. The briefing doesn't relate what the significance of those facts are. It doesn't tie them to any elements of the causes of action that Rotella and Cole asserted against Mid-Continent in the trial court. The briefing doesn't cite any authority, and it's our position that it simply does not preserve any error with regard to the summary judgment on those causes of action. That's the first point I want to make. The second point is with regard to the summary judgment itself. Rotella, and I'm just going to say Rotella as shorthand, and by Rotella I mean the Rotella Group, including Mr. Cole, including his firm. Rotella cannot, on the one hand, acknowledge, as they do in their briefing, that Mid-Continent's interpleader of this money into the court's registry was proper. They acknowledge that that was a proper course of action. They can't say that on the one hand, and then on the other hand, assert causes of action against Mid-Continent, which are nothing other than a challenge to the propriety of that interpleader. If they're accusing us of conspiring to convert the money by not paying it prior to the time we were obligated under our settlement agreement to give it to them and then tender it into the court's registry, that's a challenge to the interpleader. And Judge Collier properly recognized that and said, look, you can't say that interpleader is a proper reaction to these competing claims for the settlement money and then maintain your causes of action. And so the summary judgment was proper on those grounds. This is nothing other than a challenge to the interpleader in another guise, as Judge Collier properly recognized. And it's important to keep in mind, Your Honors, that after this settlement, immediately after this settlement, Ms. Cutting filed, sought a TRO in the federal court, which was ultimately denied. She sought a turnover of the settlement proceeds as non-exempt property. All these parties were in that federal court case, had knowledge that that was going on. Rotella cannot seriously contend that my client would have been free of any risk had we simply, while those motions were pending before Judge Fish, given him the money. That would have simply invited a lawsuit against us by Ms. Cutting. The last remedy that Ms. Cutting sought in the federal court was the application for the turnover of those settlement proceeds. That was denied by order on May 22nd. Ms. Cutting procured her writ of garnishment on May 27th. So what this lawsuit is as to Mid-Continent literally is a claim that during that five-day period, we didn't just rush over a check so that he could get the settlement proceeds and arguably frustrate whatever rights Ms. Cutting may have had in the settlement proceeds. We didn't know what the priority was. She was a judgment creditor of Rotella to the tune of $3 million. I would submit that the trial court here properly concluded there was nothing else we could have done but interplead that money in response to a writ of garnishment, and those cases are discussed in our brief, that is the proper reaction when faced with a scenario like this. I would submit that there's nothing else Mid-Continent could have done in light of the circumstances. I can go over, I don't know that I really see much point in going over each of Mr. Rotella's five causes of action against Mid-Continent: their breach of contract, conspiracy, tortious interference, breach of fiduciary duty, conversion. It's our position that all of these are simply challenges to the interpleader asserted under another name. And again, it's important to remember that they concede that once Ms. Cutting obtained a writ of garnishment, it was proper for us to interplead those funds into the court's registry. And that's exactly what we did. And there are cases on point that grant summary judgment to stakeholders on exactly these causes of action where the court has held that interpleader is proper. As to the attorney's fee issue, what Mr. Cole is complaining about is that somehow the interpleader itself is segregable from the other causes of action that he asserted and that we're only entitled to recover our fees for interpleading the money into the court's registry and not for having to move for summary judgment on these other causes of action. First of all, that's simply not correct because they are intertwined. The entire thing was a challenge to the interpleader. I'm sorry?
Did you ask for it?
Did we ask for the fees? Yes, we pled for the fees. Absolutely. Our interpleader, our initial pleading, and I think maybe we filed one amended pleading, but no, we clearly asked for our fees from day one, and that's in the record. The Jacobson case, which is cited at page 44 of our brief, is one example of a case that holds that, look, when you're talking about causes of action here that are intertwined, and I believe that may even have been in the context of an interpleader, an award of fees is proper. I'd also point out that Mr. Cole, this segregation argument does not appear in any briefing in the trial court. It's being raised for the first time here on appeal. He can't do that. So again, this is a challenge to the propriety of our interpleader. Ms. Cutting was very aggressive in terms of trying to get her hands on the money after we effected that partial settlement of the federal court case. The record establishes the existence of those competing claims, establishes the timing with regard to when we interpled that money into the court's registry, and it simply was not my client's job to try to figure out who was entitled to this money and what the priority issues were and how they were sorted out. It was our right to interplead that money into the court's registry to have Judge Collier and then this court decide where the money should have gone, and we took the only proper course that we could have. So if the panel has any additional questions, I'd like to try to answer. Thank you, Your Honor.
Approach. There is no subrogation right, whether you want to call it an assignment, contingent fee agreement. I quote from page 8 of our brief, Your Honor, Justice McCoy. I'm sorry when I first addressed this honorable court, I'm quoting from page 8 of the contingent fee agreement. Quote, the aforementioned agreement constitutes an agreement between the Rotella Group, it's a defined term, and the lawyer group, another defined term. Rotella Group means Mark Rotella and his custom home building company, and lawyer group means me and my law firm. As an assignment of a 45% interest in the recovery described above, as opposed to a contingent interest, period. This is not a contingent fee agreement, as a lawyer would ordinarily accept if it involves something like a personal injury matter, comma, like a car wreck, period. The parties signed here to understand that this agreement is a specific assignment to recoveries on insurance contracts and legal malpractice, period. More specifically, comma, this is an assignment of the interest described above on the Mid-Continent and the Great American Lloyds insurance contracts, which are specifically referenced and attached, period. Further, comma, this assignment also pertains to any proceeds as defined above, comma, on the legal malpractice litigation concerning Rotella Group and Michael Yisasaga, period. The Rotella Group assigns 45% of all proceeds generated from services performed by the lawyer group, as described in paragraphs 1. And, Your Honor, that contract, Justice McCoy, that contract for specific reference is in the clerk's record, volume 6, 0047.
I got it. Now, how do you, clearly an assignment, how do you get around, can't assign to insurance proceeds according to the insurance agreement?
It's proceeds by virtue of litigation, Your Honor. My client still owns the cause of action. But this contract...
He's assigning... So you're saying it's not... It sounds like to me it's a percentage of the results of litigation as opposed to a payment by the insurance company. But this was a payment by the insurance company.
Well, with all due respect, I see the distinction that the Honorable Court wants to make, but... It's money. It's no different than what. All I can say is, you know, I drafted the contract and we worked very hard, very, very hard to try and get this result.
Okay. Well, how do you address the fact, changing horses for a moment, that he says that they did plead for their attorney's fees and your position earlier was that they did not plead? I'm talking about the 17,556 or whatever it is. They did plead for.
Yeah, that's another good point. Your Honor, if their pleading was live because we challenged the interplea, you're talking about Mid-Continent, Your Honor?
Yeah, remember you said
but
weren't entitled to 17,556.
No, they're...
Did you plead for it?
Oh, they didn't plead it properly, okay? We never challenged, Your Honor, we never challenged their interpleader. Never did it. Never did it.
Okay, how did they plead it improperly?
Well, they didn't have a cause of action. They got to plead a cause of action.
Okay, so you're saying they asked for attorney's fees, but there wasn't a cause of action that would award attorney's fees?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. That's different from not pleading it. It's just they pled it, but they weren't entitled to it. Okay.
I might have misspoke. But we have never... Mid-Continent, I was very disappointed that they didn't deliver the $200,000 to my trust account. However, it was never contested. Their right to interplead those funds, if they so chose, that they're entitled to do that. However, it does not create a non-breach of contract, if I'm talking right. They still, when we settled in front of the mediator, Jeff Abrams, they should have paid the $200,000. We never got that money.
But $200,000 wasn't for you.
That's right. Well, part of it was.
What is your standing to sue for monies that wasn't you? Wasn't for you?
Your Honor, 45% of it was.
I thought the $200,000 was paid for the part of that, or all of that, was for the lawyer in the underlying case that had worked before we got to this point.
Yes, Your Honor. But the contingent fee agreement, we worked very hard. And, you know, it's hard to say that I won't work for free, you know. And obviously there's no evidence for this court about how hard we worked. But the contingent fee agreement says that 45% of any recovery is payable to me. Let me check my notes, Your Honor, if I might just bear the court's patience just for a little bit. And I've covered that. Nope, that's all I have, Your Honor.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Your case is submitted. And we have a turnaround. I'm kind of the facts and figures guy. We have a turnaround time on the court of around 60 to 90 days on most opinions, but some people ask me, well, Judge, how come